Good evening. Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Discourse. This is WDIY 88.1 FM. You can also find us on WDIY.org for more Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm Rhea Malhotra, your host this evening, and doing our audio engineering is Mr. Seamus McGrogan. This is the final edition of Lehigh Valley Discourse's quarterly segment, The Teen Scientist, where we bring you groundbreaking innovation in the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics disciplines, entirely from a teenage perspective. We also highlight excellence in high school independent research. This is our last episode, and today I'm glad to present our two talented seniors for the evening, Cynthia Chen and Andy Yang. On air with me today, Cynthia, our first guest, is a senior from the Harker School, all the way from Cupertino, California. Her research has focused on neural networks and oncology. Next, we'll get a chance to talk to Andy, also from California. He's a senior at the Harvard Westlake School in Los Angeles and has worked on single-cell genomics and DNA methylation studies. We can't wait to have the chance to speak with both of these incredible seniors on air with us. So let's get started right away with Cynthia. Cynthia, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. At home from the coronavirus.
Exactly. So thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me. I'm currently a senior in high school, and I've been involved with science research for the past 4 or 5 years. And I'm primarily interested in the field of bioinformatics and computational biology. So like Rhea mentioned, I'm really interested in using AI to help create solutions for diseases and stuff like that.
So how old are you and when did you exactly get started in science?
Well, I've always been interested in science, but the first time that I was involved with research was in eighth grade because my school had this after-school like science research program. And basically, I would go to that every week, and I did a project in the field of environmental engineering and presented at my regional fair, and that was, like, my first experience with science fairs and research.
Before that, did you know that you wanted to pursue research at all, or has working in labs changed the way you perceive careers in STEM?
Yeah, definitely. So before eighth grade, I didn't really know much about research and science fairs. Like, I knew they existed, but I never really had the opportunity to participate in them. But after that year, I think I became a lot more interested within like the research process. And like since that, I've done a project every year of high school, and I definitely want to pursue research in the future.
Well, let's get started on your actual research. Can you tell me a little bit about your biggest project that you've worked on over the past few years?
The biggest project that I've worked on is definitely the one that I'm like, that I've been working on for the past 2 years. Basically, the goal of that project is to develop a method to better understand neural networks, specifically trained on protein sequence data. So in order to do that, I basically developed a variety of like computer algorithms such as ranking, clustering, and visualization to try to identify specific protein sequence patterns that were related to various types of cancer. And so I've been working on that for the past 2 years.
So what was the main goal of that research? Was it to understand the neural networks better or for its biological purpose?
I would say the main goal would be to develop a method to understand neural networks better because right now, like artificial intelligence is pretty prevalent within our society and it's becoming increasingly powerful and accurate when applied to biological data sets. But we still don't really know why it's so accurate and kind of how it functions. And so in a way, it can be thought of as a black box. And so that was kind of the goal of my project was to make it less of a black box.
Have you worked with neural networks before this project, or was this your first experience really in-depth with it?
I had a little bit of experience with neural networks before. Like, my previous project before this one was a machine learning project that had a little bit of neural networks involved with it, but this was, like, my first time actually using it in-depth within research.
And so what exactly did you have these neural networks trained on? The binding patterns of B cells, or...?
Yeah, so my mentor had developed a neural network, and it was trained on this really large data set from the Cancer Genome Atlas. It was 30 million B-cell receptor sequences from 5,000 patients. And so from that, we were trying to determine specific binding patterns and protein sequence patterns that were implicated with cancer.
Could you have trained these neural networks on other types of cells, and would that have made it more accurate, or do you think that the data set that you used was probably the best for this specific study?
For this specific study, I think it was probably like the best because the TCGA data set is usually regarded as like the gold standard within like cancer data sets. But obviously there's many other neural networks that are trained on other types of data, such as images and scans of lungs or the eyes or any body part, as well as like other types of genetic sequences, such as like transcription factor sequences. So there's definitely many applications for the research.
Beyond just the understanding of neural networks, do you think that we can use this understanding of B-cell binding for other immunological diseases to stimulate the immune system to target other viral diseases?
Yeah, I think definitely knowing these B-cell receptor patterns can lead us to better understand how to develop specific cancer treatments for specific cancer types. So right now, there isn't enough specificity within cancer medicine. And so one important thing is to develop these precision medicine treatments that are more targeted towards the patient themselves, and that will hopefully be more effective and targeted.
Do you think that your research through this study and other similar ongoing research to stimulate the immune system to treat viral diseases could help maybe currently in the corona crisis to treat maybe these viruses that we don't necessarily have cures for yet?
That's an interesting question. I think the information that we specifically discovered from this study, like the B-cell receptors, I don't know if that's directly applicable to the coronavirus, but I think that if we trained another neural network on, for example, maybe like coronavirus sequences, like their RNA sequences, maybe that could help us better determine some binding patterns that they use to like invade the human system or something. I'm not really sure, but maybe it would be worth a shot.
Where did you exactly get these B-cell samples? Were they from specific patients or specific cancer types?
Yeah, they were from 5,000 patients of 13 different cancer types.
So do you think that because you had such a broad data set that it made your model more accurate?
Yeah, I think having a broad data set definitely was very crucial because not only did it allow us to have a more robust model, as you mentioned, it allowed us to generalize our results for more cancer types as well.
What was the hardest part, you think, of this project for you? Like, what was the biggest challenge that you had to maybe overcome or a hurdle that maybe was a difficult point in the study for you?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge that I faced was, so I did this project over the course of 2 summers, and in the first summer, when I was, like, developing a lot of the algorithms, I think for, like, a week or two, I was stuck on, so after, like, six weeks into the project, I had pretty weak clustering results, which basically invalidated the patterns and signatures that I found. And so that was a little bit disheartening, and it was really difficult to get like a strong correlation, so we had to fiddle around with many of our algorithms and see if anything would help improve it. And so after like a week or two, like my mentor and I like found a solution to the problem, and that was within the clustering algorithm, and it was like not behaving well. So instead of using like the built-in Python clustering algorithm, we had to like develop our own clustering algorithm. And so that was probably the biggest challenge that I faced, was identifying the problem, like the specific problem that I was facing, and then developing a solution.
So you worked on this study for 2 years. So in general, after maybe after concluding this study, how do you see that machine learning and neural networks altogether can integrate with more wet lab biology? What do you think are rooms for the field to grow into more experimental science?
Yeah, I think that's a really fascinating question. I think there's a lot of connections and applications for machine learning, deep learning, and neural networks within the field of biology, especially because there is so much data that's generated within biology every single day. And basically, AI relies on data. So this connection itself makes it really powerful. In terms of the room for the field to grow, I think that, so right now, like, neural network models, there's like a few sets of neural network models that are generally used within like TensorFlow and like a lot of very built-in frameworks. But I think it'd be interesting for like more computer scientists and wet lab biologists to like collaborate so that they can develop neural networks that are more in tune towards biological data sets.
Well, after conducting all this research, Cynthia, you've also founded your own nonprofit, Opportunity X. Can you tell me a little bit more about the mission of your organization and maybe how you've built your team and what you guys have done to make STEM more accessible?
Yeah, sure. So basically Opportunity X is a nonprofit that's based within the Bay Area. And we basically start school programs and these research programs at schools where we lead weekly workshops and we guide students through the entire science research process and help them present at science fairs.
Mm-hmm.
So we mainly target Title I schools, which are socioeconomically disadvantaged schools within the Bay Area. But we also have a few state chapters in Utah, Texas, Florida. And I would say the main goal is to help these students have an opportunity to kind of use their creativity within the sciences and help them learn these scientific and research skills as well as communication skills.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that having worked in labs yourself, it gives you a unique skill set by which to help them using your own experience?
Yeah, I think it's Opportunity X is probably pretty different from like the normal lab setting because it's pretty difficult sometimes to teach students like rather than just doing the research yourself. So I think that we have definitely faced like a couple of challenges in like engaging the students' interests as well as how to expand like our team and expanding to more schools. But I think that in terms of expanding the team, we found like a lot of success at volunteer fairs, and a lot of high school students are pretty interested in giving back to their communities and using their own science skills to further the community. And in terms of expanding to new schools, we just reach out to like a bunch of principals every year and see if we can see if there's like any match or like schools that are willing to partner with us.
Well, Cynthia, thank you so much. I hate to cut this conversation short, but it's been inspiring to hear from you today. We're actually going to take a quick break, so thank you so much again to Cynthia for being with us today and telling us about her involvement in STEM. When we return, we'll have a chance to talk to Andy Yang, a senior all the way from Los Angeles, California, about his groundbreaking research in DNA methylation. Once again, we were just talking to Cynthia Chen from the Harker School, and I'm Rhea Malhotra on Lehigh Valley Discourse. You're listening to The Teen Scientist on WDIY NPR, and we'll be back with you shortly. Hi, and welcome back to The Teen Scientist on Lehigh Valley Discourse. This is WDIY 88.1 FM, and I'm Rhea Malhotra once again. I'm now here with Senior Andy Yang. He's calling all the way from Los Angeles, California, and we're so excited to have him on air today to discuss his vast experience in computational biology research. Hi, Andy. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Rhea. How are you?
I'm good. So thank you for being on the show with us. Before we get into the details of your research, can you just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I go to Harvard Westlake. I'm a senior, and I've had a lot of experience with research at UCLA. So I've done research for about 3 years now in two labs at UCLA. One of them is computational neuroscience. The other one, computational epigenetics.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of big data biology analysis, basically. So,
how old were you exactly when you got started, and what kind of inspired you to explore research a little bit?
Yeah, so I started research when I was actual research in the lab summer of ninth grade.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was 15 probably.
Yeah.
Basically, I don't know, research has always been a huge part of my life because my dad, he does wet lab genetics, neurodegenerative disease research. So I've always been immersed in the lab environment, but I never really liked wet lab that much. I liked like programming and stuff like that. So a good cross section because I did like bio, which it seemed computational biology.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured my dad referenced me to this professor, and so I started working, and I found computational neuroscience very interesting. So I was like, okay, this is a great place to start. So yeah, that's kind of how I picked it up.
What was your first project that you worked on at UCLA?
Well, the first summer, I mostly just spent learning. Going into research, I feel like almost no one knows really anything.
Mm-hmm.
So the first year or two is almost all just learning. So I did a lot of, basically I did online courses where I bounced ideas back off of the graduate student I was working with. And I did like a machine learning course, and I did a lot of learning statistical methods and machine learning methods. But I think by the end of the summer, I had finished the 11-week course. Obviously, I like did it pretty really fast. And I also finished writing a some scripts from scratch to do like regression analysis, gradient descent, and some other statistical analysis of like calcium imaging data. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool.
So can you tell me the main outline of your newest DNA methylation project? What's the goal of this project and what have been your major findings so far?
Yeah, so this project stems from the Professor Horvath. I work for Professor Steve Horvath. Basically, I think 3-4 years ago, he discovered this DNA methylation clock, which was able to predict human age within 2 years of accuracy using any tissue, using any tissue sample. Mm-hmm. So basically you're doing like a elastic net regression analysis of methylation data, which is like a tiny chemical change in our genome. So that was his study done on humans. And then when I joined the lab, that study was already done, but he had started working on this pan-mammalian chip. So basically now we have data from, I think, 150 species and over 6,000, 7,000 samples of across all these species. So we have these methylation samples and we have traced age, average species body weight, maximum lifespan, et cetera. So the entire lab, we all have like our individual projects where we're basically investigating the dynamics of DNA methylation across species and different traits. So my project is studying the dynamics of average body weight and brain weight across tons of different species. So it's really cool because some interesting findings, for instance, are the entire lab has found that you can predict age of just any animal in general, any of the mammals of this fairly accurately using the models. And also like my study found that you can predict the average species body weight very like strongly using DNA methylation. And also I did like EWAS studies. Yeah, essentially we were able to find like specific sites that are very predictive of the body weight dynamics between species, which might explain some evolutionary dynamics, which would be pretty cool.
So why is it useful to be able to identify these body and brain weights? Are there other ways that we can do this, or does this epigenetic model to do so, is that unique in some way?
Yes, I think there's mainly like two pretty cool reasons for this. So one cool like application is that if we're able to build one analysis we run is leave one out, which essentially you train the model on all samples except and leave one species, all species, and leave one species out, and then you just run that analysis for all the species. And what we see is that even if a species is left out, the model still has pretty strong prediction on that species. So what that means is that if you don't even have a species trained in the model is fairly accurate at predicting its body weight. So for instance, if you have a random sample or a novel species that you don't know like how much it weighed, if say we were to plug this tissue into our model, we would then be able to get a rough estimate of how much that species weighed. So it'd be useful in, for instance, predicting body weight of if like the DNA methylation is preserved in say fossils or like brand new species or just random tissue that you want to know what this is. It's also probably pretty good at identifying the species too. And also the second, core biology reason is that through this study, we might be able to explain the variance of conserved traits, because we all know that like non-conserved traits largely can happen due to like mutation. Like different species have different, completely different like traits and appearance and all that stuff. But conserved traits like body weight, brain weight, like we all share these traits.
Mm-hmm.
And like we know and how evolution works on like conserved DNA, because the analysis is only done on the conserved DNA between different species. So basically this might say that, okay, DNA methylation acts as the regulator in different species to vary the weights and the brain weights between different species, which would be a very cool finding and explain parts of evolution. That would be awesome.
Yeah, definitely. What else do you think that DNA methylation and these epigenetic features can be used for as indicators in maybe pure biology research?
So one like practical use of DNA methylation is you can like monitor health. Like studies have shown that DNA methylation is like a good monitor of the effects of either diseases or substances on health. Like you see that with neurodegenerative diseases, there's accelerated DNA methylation or aging. We see like ages like 2 to 3 years ahead of what they actually are on average. Same with like nicotine use. But we also see like some factors cause decelerated aging, like running or eating healthy and having healthy lifestyle habits. Also, DNA methylation is very useful in practical observations. For instance, if you want to know, like, in crime, if you find, like, blood samples or if you want to, like, check what someone's actual age is, you can take their sample and, like, plug it into the age model, and you would be able to get a pretty accurate approximation of their age. Mm-hmm. And then there's other studies, such as on a population scale, DNA methylation can predict when you die. It's called, like, the Grimm clock. That's pretty cool. And then, like, my study with the body weight, as I mentioned earlier, doing, like, the average species body weight, like, if you take samples, you're able to predict on roughly what the body weight, what the species body weight of this sample was. But also, then again, there's tons of open-ended research being done on what DNA methylation can actually do. We're not sure if this is corollary or, like, causing. So we don't know if we can reverse DNA methylation, does this then actually reverse aging? Or, like, if we mess around with the DNA methylation in, like, different species, can we play around with its average weight, et cetera? But it's promising because DNA methylation has been proven to be, like, a DNA transcription regulatory mechanism. So changes in DNA methylation cause changes in gene expression, which is how these traits are expressed. So it's pretty promising.
Do you think that maybe in the future, with a lot more research in this area, that maybe by manipulating more methylation and epigenetic traits, that maybe the human lifespan could be extended or manipulated?
Yeah, that's kind of...
It does sound a bit ambitious, but do you think...
No, that's like a future goal, because DNA methylation, like these specific, especially pan-mammalian DNA methylation studies have been done in, like, literally, like, starting, like, the last 2 years. So we're still in the exploring phase, I think, of just understanding what things DNA methylation is kind of related to. But there are studies being done. I know a recent study, I think it was like a thymoid transplant, reversed DNA methylation age, but it's way too early to know what exactly DNA methylation is capable of. And we still need to, we still need to just figure out, like, what things it's related to. And we also have to do all the, like, EWAS studies to then find out which sites or specific DNA methylation CpGs might be related to. And there's basically tons of studies that have to be done before we really know what DNA methylation is capable of.
Definitely. My last question about this project specifically, so you said you studied about 68 mammals in this project, but do you think that if you apply the same techniques to other species, it would expand the model to maybe, like, reptiles per se, or other species outside mammals alone?
We're not 100% sure about that. I know for a fact that the more, like, evolutionarily different species are, the less correlated they are, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. For instance, you know, like, marsupials in Australia, there's, like, divergent evolution there because they're all isolated in their own little continent. Their DNA methylation traces for, like, weight and age actually are, like, vary from the rest of the species, which kind of evolved more closely. So I would presume, and I think I'm like, pretty sure this is true, you probably have to create the model for the separate, like, for reptiles or something. But I'm sure, like, as a whole, if you train it on, like, every single animal, it would perform okay. But it, like, the more concentrated on specific groups you get, the better it performs.
Yeah, it'd probably be more accurate.
At
college next year, so you're attending Yale University, so I assume you definitely want to continue research there as well. Do you think you want to stick within computational biology, or do you think that your work might stray more into experimental?
Yeah, so, like, my main interests are basically applied machine learning and data science. So I think I'm, especially because, like, I already have so much experience in computational biology, I'm probably gonna maybe shift to a more technical biology, like, lab, like, maybe more applied AI, because a lot of the stuff I do right now is there's machine learning, but it's not like deep AI or anything like that. I might want to try doing like some deep AI applied in biology, but also to keep up, like, all the more common biostatistics stuff, because I definitely want to get a strong background in machine learning, because I'm probably going to major in, like, stats and data science. Mm-hmm. But I also want to keep up the like the biology part, because I'm really interested in biology. So yeah.
Definitely. Well, Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on The Teen Scientist. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today, and it was a pleasure having you on air. Thank you to both Andy Yang and Cynthia Chen for discussing their research with us today, because it's been fascinating just to listen to you both speak so passionately about your work. Thank you for tuning in with us today on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Discourse. Once again, we were on air with Andy Yang and Cynthia Chen, So especially thank you to them for speaking with us. And as always, thank you to Mr. Seamus McGrogan for doing our audio engineering this evening. I'm Rhea Malhotra, and this is WDIY 88.1 FM Radio. This was our last segment of The Teen Scientist, but be sure to tune in next time for more Lehigh Valley Discourse.